then immediately I ask Fred Abbott to present the work that he's been doing for ICTSD on, among other things, taking or drawing lessons from the global policy development on intellectual property and health in relation to the current discussions on climate change. Fred, you have 15 minutes.
Good afternoon. It's a great pleasure to be here with all of you, and in particular, I'm very grateful that the chair of the Standing Committee on the Law of Patents is able to be here with us. We're honored by his presence and his stewardship of that meeting. As Pedro mentioned, ICTSD asked me to prepare this study on looking at some potential implications of the public health negotiations and solutions for the area of climate change. I first presented the background paper in the Poznan meeting based on the feedback on that. We're now in the second revision and the third and final and hopefully public then presentation of the paper itself will be within the next few weeks. So what I'm going to try to do is, in 12 minutes, draw the key lessons of public health dialogue for the past decade and then translate those lessons into the field of climate change. Of course, I'll be leaving out some of the elements, but hopefully this will give at least a flavor of the subject matter. I would add that at least three quarters of the people in this room have been very much involved in this entire process. And therefore, all I am really trying to do is capture a shared experience, and you can naturally make your own determination as to whether or not I've captured the lessons properly. So I'm going to suggest eight fundamental lessons from the public health negotiations. The first one, which I would say your reaction will be, well, that's obvious, but I would respond to you, yes, it is obvious, but it is still true. And that is economic and political power matters, that who wins in negotiations is very much based on the effective power of the negotiators. What we found in the public health negotiations is that it is therefore important for the less strong players to form and maintain strategic alliances, number one, and number two, that despite everything one does, one cannot discount the role of external factors in shaping the environment. Back in the public health and Doha negotiations, for example, we had a very dramatic effect of the September 11th event. Today, with climate change, we have a very dramatic impact of the global financial crisis. Both of those things were external events which were unpredictable, but nonetheless will have very substantial effects. Stakeholder involvement is essential. One of the main, and one might even say only, reasons that progress was made in the public health negotiation was due to the pressure exerted by non-governmental organizations on the multilateral institutions. Third, and I think perhaps very important for the climate change area, is zero-sum bargaining is unlikely to be successful. And I would add to that that appeals to equity have limited impact on the business community. And I don't really mean that in a cynical or negative way. That is, the business community is incentivized by the desire to earn return on investment. Not necessarily incentivized by the desire to do world public good. And so one of the lessons that we want to translate into climate change is, how do we incentivize return on investment rather than merely trying to appeal to the desire to do public good. The third is that technology transfer requires concrete mechanisms. Now, we've seen this repeatedly over the course of multilateral negotiations since the 1950s and 1960s, and often in recent negotiations, both bilateral and multilateral, the provisions on technology transfer tend to be the last exhausted provisions of an economic negotiation, and typically framed as, we agree that we will get together after this is all over and decide on some elements of technology transfer. I'll come back to that a bit. I've been very directly involved in trying to implement some of those exhausted provisions on technology transfer and why I think we need to move that up on the agenda. Now, these are things, again, which were critical to public health, whether they're so critical in the extent to climate change. First, communication is very important, particularly by developing country governments. OECD governments work very hard to shape media perceptions, particularly in the negotiating context. Lesson number six, forum shifting can undermine gains. I phrase this as it's not over till it's over. That is, we saw that one of the unintended consequences of the whole Doha process was to shift intellectual property negotiations into bilateral and regional negotiations, which in many particular instances are resulting in rules that are more restrictive than existed prior to the Doha process. So you can't assume because you win in forum A, you're going to win in forum B, C, and D over the long term. And we saw that human rights values were very important in shaping the Doha dialogue, even if particular human rights weren't always invoked to play a specific role. What are some of the lessons we specifically learned about intellectual property? Well, one, again, a lesson known to everyone in this room, but that doesn't mean it's not true. And that is that patents do not have a uniform effect across fields of technology. I would argue that patents have a very different impact in the field of public health than they do in potentially in the field of climate change. Of course, one can say that remains to be seen. But the pharmaceutical industry is highly dependent on strong patent protection. The climate change industries may not be highly dependent on strong patent protection. And there may be substantial differentials in the way these mechanisms work. I think this was essentially a fundamental flaw in the non-discrimination premise of the TRIPS agreement, the idea that everything would be treated the same. Of course, Bob Hudak helped us out by pointing out that discrimination and differentiation weren't the same thing, but we still have to look at the premise, captured as you cannot divorce the industrial policy instrument from its social welfare effects. Of course, in public health, this leads us to a number of recommendations. My own most favored, which I think really might work well in the climate change area, is the idea of scalable rewards based on the level of contribution. That is, we do not need to treat all innovation as entitled to the same type of reward. We may be able to work with more or less a scalable patent system, which I refer to as a quasi-patent system. Other things, of course, which have come out of the public health negotiations are the importance of tightening the standards of patentability and decoupling invention rewards and end-user pricing. Now, what Nick Johnson has just presented to you is precisely what we're talking about here. That is, before we really get into whether and what types of changes to rules, exceptions, and so forth we might want to see in the climate change area, we really need to do a strong assessment of the potential public welfare impacts of technology restrictions. John Barton made a statement some years ago at a meeting at Duke University that patents are too important to leave to patent lawyers. And in this area, we really need to bring in a wide range of experts from a broad cross-section of fields to look not only at specific technology impacts, but impacts on the social welfare of people who are dealing with these problems. Of course, one of those suggestions will lead to, well, let's establish teams of experts. And I add just one small caution here, to avoid the governance seconding process of expert selection, because you go to each government and say, okay, we're going to have an expert committee, you're going to each nominate an expert, and you essentially end up with the same government positions coming out of the experts that would have come out of the governments themselves. So we need good ways to establish expert committees with the ultimate objective, as Nick suggests, of identifying key potential bottlenecks and mechanisms to address them. One of the positive aspects of public health is if we haven't thought by now of every potential option for dealing with technology and patents, it's, well, of course, we can't predict the future, but it's hard to know what else we might think of. So we do have a very broad range of options that we've had under consideration. So getting to technology transfer, again, from my own experience in trying to implement these provisions, the concrete and specific rights and obligations are critical. Promises of future consideration are rarely fulfilled. I've had the experience under these technology transfer provisions of going to the industry and saying our governments have encouraged us to share technology. Would you please provide them? And the frank, literal answer is, why would we do that? You're asking us to share technology with our potential competitors. That's not in our business interest. It just doesn't make sense. And if that's what we might call the rational response of industry, we also have to recognize that governments do not predominantly control technology. The private sector does. I mentioned they're motivated by return on investment. So my suggestion is that meaningful technology transfer will require financial incentives for the private sector. My own, I suppose, easy preferred mechanism is to try to work out very concrete mechanisms for joint venture arrangements that would involve the multilateral industries from the OECD countries and industries in the developing countries, where you would be providing economic incentives to both industry sides to profit out of these ventures. And I strongly suspect that there's a good role that multilateral institutions can play in this process by establishing frameworks, by establishing tax incentives, and so forth, to make these types of win-win arrangements possible. Finally, I'm going to turn, Pedro, I hope I still have 2 minutes?
See.
Three, okay. So, assessing the Doha Declaration. Well, this was, okay, a positive step in modifying the political environment. It helps the development of public international law, which is a long-term exercise. It certainly had the positive effect of heightening attention to problems and stimulating concrete action. Among other things, you have the WHO pre-qualification program and wider acceptance of generics, U.S. PEPFAR, DMDI, deeper involvement of the WHO, special treatment for least developed countries. And I think all of these things flowed from the Doha Declaration, and we'll call it the Doha process. But no one, I think, would call it a panacea. The political environment continues to discourage use of flexibilities. We saw that very dramatically, particularly in the case of Thailand, also in the case of Brazil and their compulsory licensing. The recent EU-Dutch seizures of generic products in transit are leading to a whole new era of backsliding in kind of the Doha process, requiring us to build up again the kind of goodwill that we were trying to establish. And I would also say that the structure of the pharmaceutical sector has not been changed by the Doha Declaration. You still have the predominant originator industries in the OECD countries. They've now begun acquiring the major Indian generic producers. That's going to lead to a diminution in the level of political activity from the generic sector. So these are things that haven't been really changed by the Doha process. So do we want a declaration on IPRs and public and climate change? Well, I'll start with the premise that everybody in this room knows what the TRIPS agreement does, and that everyone has a pretty good understanding that the TRIPS agreement has a lot of built-in flexibilities, and if you took advantage of those flexibilities, that you might not need to negotiate new intellectual property rules to deal with climate change. But is that enough? Is that enough to shape the political environment? It may not be. Well, first one question, is it possible to have constructive discussions? I personally wouldn't really welcome years of acrimonious debate that would create an unwelcome diversion from tackling the climate change problem. So a lot of thinking needs to go into the potential groundwork for a constructive political declaration. Second, do we only need an understanding, as was largely the Doha Declaration, or do we also need to modify express terms of the TRIPS agreement? For example, is there a new Article 31F problem in the climate change area? I'm not going to address that. Finally, what would be the optimal forum for this? And again, things that maybe we could all agree on, that the objective of this would be to have a globally coherent policy, not an institution-by-institution policy. Well, how could you have a globally coherent policy? Well, probably the widest organization is the UN General Assembly, but there's a lot of people who favor the UN Framework Convention of Climate Change Forum. Could you have a multilateral joint organization declaration that would be simultaneously issued by all of these involved organizations? I'm sure I've left off one or two to the offense of somebody, but by illustration, those that are listed there. And finally, what mechanism would we contemplate for resolving disputes about all of this? Would it be the International Court of Justice, or would we have a new self-standing dispute settlement mechanism, and are we anticipating that remedial measures might be recommended or endorsed by such a dispute settlement mechanism? Well, I really, in the scope of 12 minutes, raise these things as things to think about. I hope I've decently captured our general understanding of what happened in public health, and I'm hoping that some of those lessons may be useful to the climate change community. Thank you.
Thanks very much, Fred. I think it has been extremely comprehensive. We look forward, really, to the revised version of your paper that should be published quite